Today's episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast is brought to you by Skillshare. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents at skillshare.com/creative. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm the founder of Accidental Creative and the author of several books, including The Accidental Creative, of course, and the new book, Herding Tigers, Be the Leader That Creative People Need, which is all about how to create an environment in which creative teams thrive. Here on the show, we talk about you and your process and how we can be prolific, brilliant, and healthy all at the same time as creative professionals. As people have to go to work and solve problems and do work for clients and deal with the pressures and demands of creating on demand every day. And one of the things we like to do on the show, as we've done for the last, 13 years that the show has been in existence, is feature people who have actually produced work that has transformed culture in some way. And on today's show, we have just one of those people. We have Ken Kashenda. Ken was on the team at Apple for about 15 years and was largely responsible for developing much of the software that you currently use if you use an iPhone. And he's going to talk to us about the Apple design process. He just wrote a book called Creative Selection. He's going to talk us through what it was like to be at Apple during the time when they were turning the ship and creating some of the most innovative products in the history of the industry. We're going to talk about Apple's design process, what it was like to pitch to Steve Jobs, for crying out loud, and lots, lots more that we can draw from in our own work every day. Before we jump into the interview with Ken, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by Skillshare. If you've been listening to this show for any period of time, you know I'm a huge fan of lifelong learning. Listen, if you want to continue growing, not just in your career, but also as a human being, it's important to commit yourself to lifelong growth. Well, Skillshare is your partner in that effort. Skillshare is an online learning platform with over 20,000 classes in business, marketing, technology, design, and more. You can take classes in social media marketing, data science, web development. If you can name it, they probably have it. You could probably find a class on Skillshare to help you develop that skill. So whether you're trying to deepen your professional skill set, you want to start a side hustle, or maybe you just want to explore a new passion, Skillshare is there to keep you learning and thriving. So one of my favorite features of Skillshare is that on a weekly basis, they'll send you recommended classes. So these are classes based upon your interests, other classes you've taken. So I get a weekly mix of classes. It's kind of like on Spotify, you know how they put together your daily mix. This is kind of what Skillshare does with classes. So for example, this week, some of my recommended classes are creating your social media content strategy in under 90 minutes. They know that I'm interested in social media strategy because I'm always trying to figure out how to better connect with the people I serve. There's a course called Storytelling for Leaders, How to Craft Stories That Matter by Keith Yamashita. What an amazing opportunity to learn from one of the best. This is just a sample of the courses you can take on Skillshare. So if you want to develop, if you want to grow, you have to commit to that. I encourage you to check out Skillshare. Join the millions of students learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for listeners of the Accidental Creative. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering the Accidental Creative listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 20,000 classes for just 99 cents. It's a great deal. To sign up, go to skillshare.com/creative. Again, that's skillshare.com/creative to start your 2 months now. We thank Skillshare for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, our guest today is Ken Kashenda. He is, well, among other things, he's the author of a brand new book called Creative Selection, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs. He was working for Apple and helped develop some of the incredibly innovative technology that all of us carry around in our pockets today. Ken, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
I loved this book. And part of it, Ken, is because I have been a student of Apple for a long time. And I, you know, it's very rare, as you know, that we really get a peek under the hood of what happens inside of Apple. And so to have someone who was such an integral part of developing the technology that we all use today come out and say, well, let me talk a little about our process. It's such a rare thing. So could you start just by telling us a little about yourself and tell us a little bit about your role at Apple during the 15 years that you were with the company?
Right. Well, I was involved in the software teams. So on products like the iPhone, I was part of a pretty small group of people responsible for making the user interface software, what we call iOS today. But really, it's that level of the software that sits on top of all of the technologies, you know, lower down in the software stack. I worked on the software. I mean, I probably put buttons on the screen that your listeners, you know, reach out and tap every day. And on the iPhone itself, for the original iPhone, I developed the keyboard and autocorrection.
Yeah. So all of those damn you autocorrect memes, you were the source of all of that.
I am the source of that. Yes, I am to blame. Yes.
That's great. So one of the very first anecdotes, stories in the book is about you going in to demo autocorrect for Steve Jobs. What was it like to demo something for Steve Jobs?
Well, Steve was very focused on making great products. And maybe that's not surprising to your listeners, but it's worth stressing. He was absolutely laser focused on making great products. And so that's what he cared about. And so when someone like me, you know, an engineer, on the staff brought him a piece of work, it could be pretty intimidating because that focus on the work meant that, well, he was maybe less focused on social graces. So if you brought him something and he didn't like it, he told you. And knowing that going in, it could be pretty intimidating. But the flip side of that is that he was always so open to liking new things. You could show him something new, something he never saw before. And if he liked it, and then if he gave his approval, well, then of course, you know, the work would go out to hundreds of millions of people out in the world. So for me, even though it was intimidating, it was a pretty good bargain to play for that possibility, that potential of getting my work out into the world.
Yeah, there is a double-edged sword, I guess, with that kind of personality, right? Somebody with that kind of power and that kind of approach, which is that you always know where you're going to stand, which is the blessing of it. But it's potentially you're painting a giant target on yourself, and you have to have a pretty firm sense of self and your capabilities in order to be able to withstand the hurricane when the feedback came fast and furious.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, and you raise a good point. Is that once he says what he thinks, you know where you stand. You know what his opinion is. But walking in, you never really know. Because one of the interesting aspects of his whole process as an editor and as the leader of the product development organization was that he would change his opinion sometimes. So in one demo, you might bring him in a piece of work and he said that he liked it. And then turn around the next day and say, no, I've thought about it. Now I hate it. Yeah. And so, you know, it could be kind of a roller coaster sometimes. But, you know, at any particular moment, you knew where you stood and you knew what you were supposed to do next. And so maybe that was a bit of a saving grace. But, you know, of course, you know, your listeners are probably well aware, you know, in a creative process, things don't always go according to plan. The plans need to change in order for the work to come out right.
Yeah, and you learn things, right? You can't fossilize around yesterday's assumptions because yesterday's assumptions are disproven by today's experience. And, you know, I think that's, again, one of the blessings of being in an honest environment where people are willing to speak the truth, or at least the truth as they perceive it, is that you're going to be a learning organization when that happens. There's no avoiding the learning process when you're being confronted with new perceptions on a daily basis.
And it's interesting too, and it's absolutely right, you know, and in a field like software, where so many things can change, it's such a flexible medium. It can be whatever you want, and so the constraints are pretty loose. And so one of the other aspects of Steve's leadership, which helped to guide our work throughout the development of products like the iPhone and the iPad, is that he was very decisive. He could take that seemingly infinite range of possibility and narrow it down for you. So, again, returning to this theme of getting clear guidance, knowing where you stand, I think the important aspect of that is knowing what to do next. Mm-hmm. So when you, you know, bring him a piece of work and he tells you what to do, you also have clear guidance on what you should do when you get back to your office.
Yeah. Well, and this plays into the title of the book, actually, which is a really interesting phrase, creative selection. Why did you use that term to describe Apple's creative process?
Right. Well, I thought back as I started to write this book, I thought back on, well, how did we do the work? What was there about our process? And so this creative selection idea came up pretty early. It speaks to this Darwinian evolutionary way of approaching work. So when we got an idea, we got a little inspiration or a dream for something that we might want to make, what we did very, very early on was we made something concrete. So for me, I would make a demo and load it onto usually a prototype piece of hardware, like an iPhone. And then I would go show it to somebody, an office mate or a colleague on the hall, and try to get reactions really, really quickly. Begin that feedback coming in, and then I'd react to the feedback and create the next version. And then after a couple more versions, showing, getting feedback from colleagues, I'd show it to managers and executives and eventually all the way up to Steve. So we would have this long set of generations taking that idea that, you know, maybe even from the start, it wasn't so good, but that initial feedback comes in and helps to make it better. And so our process was all about iteration. Start from wherever you are. Start from your idea, but make something concrete as soon as you can, and then just keep improving it as you go along. Get more and more feedback. Try to incorporate that feedback. Get rid of the weak parts and accentuate the strong parts.
Well, and I think that sharing early and getting feedback early is such wonderful advice to anyone in any field, because I think often we hide our ideas close to our vest because we're afraid of getting the feedback. We're afraid of disconfirmation, right? Of being told you're wrong or that's a terrible idea. And we don't want to deal with the discomfort of that. And you have to just mature through that if you want to produce great work.
It's true. And to overcome the inertia, this trepidation that you mentioned, and I think a lot of times what we all do in creative work is we try to hedge. We don't want to put ourselves out there. We don't want to create that first demo or prototype or sketch because, well, those first efforts usually aren't very good.
Yes.
But again, you know, this creative selection idea is all about getting that first bit of work down there, because that's where you start from. You evolve from that early stage. Yeah. And if you don't have that early stage, well, then where is the final result going to come from? You have to start somewhere.
Yeah. So, you know, people may not even realize, a lot of people may not realize if you haven't followed closely, but I mean, Apple was basically in danger of being sold for scrap parts in the late 1990s. You know, I mean, Apple was not doing well. And then from the late 90s through today, Apple has become, I mean, one of the most dominant forces in the world, in the business world, you know, being valued at $1 trillion, for example. You know, Apple leapfrogged so many of its competitors that looked so strong in the late 1990s, and over the course of about 10 to 15 years, it just leapfrogged them and outperformed them by multiples. What was the secret sauce? You know, what was the secret sauce to Apple being able to do that?
Well, you know, I think it is a matter of just creating things that people like. And, you know, I think it was also a matter of not waging the old wars again, not trying to, you know, refight the PC battles. Mm-hmm. You know, and you say late 90s, you know, I joined Apple in 2001. So even in the 21st century, when I joined the company, it was still 4 months away from releasing the iPod. Mm-hmm. Of course, the iPhone was years in the future relative to that. And when I joined, Apple, the Mac was the company's main product, and it had less than 5% market share. I mean, everybody was, you know, the whole tech world was dominated by Microsoft Windows. And so part of the secret also was Steve wanted Apple to be relevant again. not only in the market so that the company would survive as a going concern, but also be relevant in people's minds. Yes. And so it was products like the iPod, and which set the stage for the iPhone, that was part of this transformation from Apple Computer to Apple Inc.
Yeah.
Right. To become a personal technology company. Yeah.
And I remember that that transition was huge. And I remember when that happened, suddenly it was like planting a flag in the ground. It is a new day for Apple when the name physically changed.
Right. Right. And it's one, I'm going to throw out a word, which is, maybe overused, but almost certainly overused, which is innovation. But I think the story of the iPod and then the iPhone and then the iPad and the Apple Watch and the products that followed showed that, there are always opportunities to innovate. Even back when I started at Apple in 2001, the company was truly, truly an underdog. Mm-hmm. And that there is always an opportunity to change the story if you're open to doing new things. And of course that can be really scary and there's a lot of risk, but there's also, as we can see now with Apple being a $1 trillion company, the potential for a lot of rewards as well.
Yeah. So your background is in liberal arts, right? Which is maybe a unique background for someone in your field.
It's actually not. So my college degree is in history. I don't have a computer science degree.
Oh, wow.
of any sort. And I learned programming along the way. But one of the people who figures in my book very much and also figures in my career very much, the fellow who was in the next office for many years, Richard Williamson, he's a philosophy major. So, both he and I were two of the first people making Safari and WebKit, the web browser for the Mac. And
yes.
And he and I were, among the first six or eight people working on the iPhone as well, doing the software that became iOS and UIKit. And so, it's not that not that uncommon at Apple. It's actually pretty common for people to have different educational backgrounds and not necessarily in computing.
And is that part of the hiring philosophy? I mean, is that an intentional thing or is it just something that, people of that sort are drawn to Apple?
Well, I think it is. Yeah, I think people like that are drawn to Apple, but it's also part of this approach, this philosophy that Steve Jobs even talked about years ago on stage. It was during one of the announcements for the first iPad. He talked about how Apple works at the intersection. The intersection of liberal arts and technology. So that to make the kind of product that Apple considers great, it needs to bring together hardware and software and networking. I mean, the technology needs to be there, but also it needs to combine with the best of design and culture and everything else that makes our creative and personal lives what they are. I mean, everything that gives the richness to to our everyday interactions and taps into our intuition for how things can work. Again, the best of design and culture needs to be there along with the hardware and software to make a great product.
Yeah, I often in my speaking and consulting and working with companies, I tell leaders, you need to stop exclusively studying your industry because the next great idea for your industry is probably not going to come from inside of your industry. It's going to come from you reading a Walter Isaacson biography or, studying the American Revolution or planting a garden, right? Or something like your next great idea is going to come from somewhere else.
It's absolutely true. And you never know where those ideas are going to come from. You never really know. And in my background, I studied history. I also spent time trying to become a fine art photographer and studied a lot of the history of art. And those bits of study come out in the work. If you really do steep yourself in art and design and culture, as a technologist, as I was, it helps to give you that perspective, that extra, you know, that extra something that you don't really know where the ideas will come from. But again, they've got to come from somewhere. And like you say, you know, looking outside of your industry or field, you know, may allow you to make the kinds of combinations that have never been obvious, but seem right when they happen.
Yeah. Well, so one principle I think of human nature, and especially of business, is that everything feels inevitable in retrospect. You know, and I think now people hold the iPhone in their hand and say, well, of course, this is what a phone should feel like, you know, because that, and I try to explain to my kids, like, let me show you what a phone looked like prior to the iPhone. I mean, do you understand how revolutionary this was? And we're talking about the version one iPhone, which, you know, was incredible for its day. But you look at it now and you look at how things have advanced, and it just is, you know, it's remarkable what's happened over the last handful of years. But was there ever a moment, Ken, when you thought this might not fly, this might not work?
Yes, absolutely. There were many moments. Certainly, in my work on the keyboard for the original iPhone, we kind of jokingly and sometimes not so jokingly referred to the development of the keyboard as a science project. We weren't sure whether, you know, those gurgling test tubes were going to explode or not, and we were going to wind up with a product that we couldn't ship. But you see that, you know, that change from the way that phones were. I mean, we think about the BlackBerry as probably the smartphone that stands out in our minds from the pre-iPhone era. Right. And of course, what did that have? That had a hardware keyboard, the little plastic keys, right, on, you know, beneath the screen above. And the whole concept for the original iPhone was to get that hardware keyboard out of there, turn this keyboard into software, so that it could get out of the way when you weren't entering text, which, of course, then opened up the device to become an app platform. It became a larger canvas than for developers out in the world to add their own ideas, add their own apps, and the whole system, the whole product, just became that much more flexible because the whole front face of the device could become whatever you wanted, whether it be a camera or a calendar, right, or a web browser or a game. You know, that risk that we took, and that some of it, you know, landed on my shoulders to make a software keyboard, in the end was really worth it. It was a risk that, again, has paid off handsomely for Apple, but I think also for people out in the world.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, most people, you know, I think a lot of people will say they wouldn't leave their house without their phone in their pocket or their bag or having it with them. So that's, it worked. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and you know, you mentioned, you know, the platform that the iPhone became, but even there's a lesson in how the iPhone was launched, which is, listen, there are going to be a set number of fixed apps. We're not going to open this up to the world right now because we want to make sure that people have a great user experience from the beginning. Because if you had launched the iPhone and there were all kinds of buggy third-party apps on there and it crashed all the time, people are going to say, forget this, I'm going back to the flip phone, right? It would have been terrible, right. A terrible experience.
Right. I mean, that first experience with a product is really important. I mean, it's like the first impression when you meet someone. Right. I mean, that those impressions really are important and form our opinion of a product or experience. It's very hard to dislodge. And so we wanted as much as possible to make that small set of apps that shipped on the original phone really, really great. And to maintain that control. And we, of course, at the same time, we were still learning how should a touchscreen operating system work.
Yeah.
That whole model of a grid of apps on a home screen, you tap one of the apps, it takes over the whole screen. And then when you're in an app, apps go side to side to navigate back and forward within the content of the app. And then you press the home button, and then the whole app shrinks back down. So this kind of in and out to go between apps, and then side to side to navigate the content within apps. And we don't really think about it that much, but this was something that needed to be invented from scratch.
Well, and again, you know, everything seems inevitable in retrospect, right? Now it's just, of course, it's obvious how it should work, but no, not at all. You know, it was so innovative, and it's crazy. And I'm sure you've seen the photos of, or the videos of babies looking at magazines and trying to scroll and trying to touch photos and make that, you know, it's like, you know, it just, it's so intuitive, and it's so how the human mind works that we're really sort of retraining ourselves to, you know, about how we should interact with the world in new ways.
It's interesting. If you look at young kids, I mean, I'm sure we've all had this experience of being with a young child, the first time that they make a gesture that is intentional, it's with their index finger pointing at something.
Yeah.
It's so basic to how we as humans interact with the world, to directly manipulate the objects that we see. And so that was, again, an important aspect of that we wanted to bring to the touchscreen operating system, was that if you see something on the display, you can interact with it, touch it. Yeah. And it will respond in a way that seems sensible and intuitive. And of course, that's really hard to do. I mean, you mentioned this looking back in retrospect, but you know, when we were trying to discover what these interaction models should be, boy, we had a lot of false starts for sure.
Sure. All right, I have one more question for you. What is a valuable lesson that you learned during your time at Apple that you still find yourself applying in your life today? It doesn't have to be with your work. I mean, just in, you know, in life in general, what is a valuable lesson you learned that shaped how you think about your life?
Right. I think just keep going. The lesson that of all of the software that I developed and that made it out into Apple products was that even unpromising beginnings can wind up having really wonderful outcomes if you just keep going. You know, it's this persistence, this diligence that if you don't accept sort of half measures or, you know, partially good results, but you kind of keep your nose to the grindstone. I mean, it maybe sounds a bit cliched, but I think it's one of those things that doesn't sound like a secret when you say it, but it really is.
Yeah.
Well, get an idea, keep drilling away at it. And, you know, just keep improving, your work as you go. Get feedback from people.
Mm.
Develop a thick skin and keep going.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Well, we have only scratched the surface of the depths of insight that are in this book, but the book is called Creative Selection: Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs. The author is Ken Kushinda. Ken, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. What's the best way for people to find you if they're looking for you?
Right. Well, you can go to creativeselection.io. And that will give you some more information about my book and some links to buy it. You can type in Creative Selection as two words in your favorite search engine. And I'm on Twitter at Kushinda. That's Kocienda.
Fantastic. Well, Ken, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
And as always, many thanks to you for listening. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.